This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
It is 2 o'clock, so please welcome to the stage Emma Slade, Justin Butcher, Guy Stagg and Paul Blizzard.
Right. Have you all bought your holidays?
Oh God, horrible feedback, sorry. How's the destination show? Have you all found your holiday of a lifetime yet? Okay, quick question before we start. This is a pilgrim panel, and so the word pilgrimage has resonance for so many people, whether secular or spiritual pilgrims. Can you hear me?
No, a bit.
Okay, can you hear me now? Should we start again? Welcome to London. How many of you, I want to know, have been on what you would consider a pilgrimage, whether secular or spiritual? You've either gone to Rome or you've walked to Santiago, or a good few of you. Right. The three writers that we have here, each of whom have written a very distinctive, very personal story of pilgrimage, are Emma in the middle, Guy to my far left, and Justin to my immediate left. And Justin, I'm going to start with you. With your definition of what you consider a pilgrimage to be and why you went on one, could we start in that area, please?
I guess a pilgrimage, in general terms, is a journey which has some kind of spiritual significance. That's your first question. For me, the book Walking to Jerusalem is about a pilgrimage which I organized in 2017, working with the human rights charity Amos Trust, to mark three very significant anniversaries in the Palestinian struggle. 2017 was the perfect storm of anniversaries in the Palestinian story. 10 years of the blockade of Gaza, 50 years of Israel's military occupation of the Palestinian territories, and the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. 1917, when Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, wrote the famous declaration which Palestinians point to as the primary betrayal of their rights. A letter addressed to the current Lord Rothschild in 1917, pledging the support of the British Empire for the establishment of a national homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. The second part of the declaration was it being clearly understood that nothing should be done to prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, by which he meant the Palestinians, 90% of the population. They didn't have a name. They were relegated to the status of non-Jews. They didn't have political rights, significantly. They had whatever civil rights means. They had those, and they had religious rights. But what we know, a century later, is that the second part of the declaration was never fulfilled. Nothing has ever been done to protect the civil, religious, or political, or even human rights of the Palestinian people. The actions of the British government a century ago precipitated 100 years of dispossession, injustice, tragedy, suffering from the Palestinian people. And so, bearing in mind these three huge anniversaries running together, I conceived a walk to Jerusalem, from London to Jerusalem, as a kind of pilgrimage of penance. I wanted to try and create an event, a stunt, if you like, which would mark these three anniversaries and would express the empathy, the sorrow, and the solidarity of many, many people, not just in Britain, but across the world, for the Palestinian struggle. It's particularly important for us as Brits to do that because it's the actions of our government and our empire which created that mess. In the first place. And we are the inheritors of that legacy, whether we like it or not. And so it was a pilgrimage of penance, it was a march of solidarity, and we called it also a walk of hope. And we had a sort of liturgy that we said each day together. We walk, which concluded with the words, we walk in hope that one day all people in the Holy Land will live in peace as neighbors with full equal rights.
Okay. Good. That's a good summary.
Yeah.
You walked to Jerusalem for a very good cause. Emma, can I come to you next then? Same question, really. For those that aren't familiar with Emma, now, obviously, a Buddhist nun or monk, what's the terminology?
Nun,
yeah, thank you. Former investment banker, what do you understand? What did you used to understand by the word pilgrimage? How would you understand it now?
Well, obviously, as an investment banker, I hadn't really thought about the idea of pilgrimage, yeah. As a Buddhist nun, I would say that pilgrimage is to go to the essence of what it is to be human.
That's very succinct. Can you elaborate?
Well, I think after a while, especially after some life experience, seeing the suffering as we've just heard about, yeah. Also seeing the great inspirational acts of kindness in the world, I think we all have to think deeply about who we are and what we want to do with the time that we have, which is limited.
Yes.
And I think a decision to go on pilgrimage for many people is about placing a mirror up to see their own nature. And on the way, they may encounter many obstacles, but hopefully they will find a place which brings them to a point of peace and understanding. And from it, they can then return clearer and perhaps make a more wonderful contribution to the world.
You're verging on something which I hadn't thought about, which is, of course, one assumes that pilgrimage requires a physical journey from point A to point B, whether in penance, whether in piety, whether a secular journey or a spiritual journey. Are you saying that pilgrimage can also be an interior journey, a journey of the soul?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, the easiest thing to move is your body. That's the easiest thing to move, isn't it? It's the easiest thing to know. It's the easiest thing to boss around. You know, then you've got your speech, to know your speech, direct it well, and then you've got your mind. Obviously, for instance, I think you would all know that China invaded Tibet, and many Tibetan monks and nuns were placed in jails for many, many years. And many of them made enormous pilgrimages in their minds and even wrote incredible books when they came out. So profound were their experiences locked in a jail. So I think we have to be open to the notion of pilgrimage in body, speech, and mind. Yeah.
Nicely put. Thank you, Emma. Guy, finally, by way of introduction, your pilgrimage, not unlike Justin's, was from Britain to Jerusalem. You walked it. Why?
I think that for me, the main difference between a pilgrimage and just going on a hike, going rambling, is not the spiritual religious site you end up reaching. It's not about walking to Jerusalem or Rome or wherever you choose. I think the crucial difference is that a pilgrimage is a journey undertaken with an intention for some form of self-transformation. And that's why, even if you're not a believer or you're not sure where exactly you sit in the religious tradition that the pilgrim incorporates, I think that religious tradition can be helpful all the same, because what that does is it gives you a set of moral standards or a set of rituals that you can measure your own progress against. And if you're walking with this intention for some form of self-transformation, you can use that as a roadmap in order to test your own self and the transformation that's taking place.
How did that work for you? Because your book, The Crossway, is an extraordinary piece of writing. It's deeply personal, very profound in many ways. And as Emma hinted at, any good pilgrimage requires meeting challenges and learning about yourself through the challenges that you meet. And you met a lot of challenges before and during the walk. But you also met a lot of people, and you're very good upon how an act of pilgrimage, although often seen as a solo endeavour,
yes,
is in fact much more collaborative than most people will admit to or recognise.
Yes.
Can you talk us through that?
So I began walking my own journey to Jerusalem. I began walking after quite a long period of mental illness. And I'd come out of that, but I still felt as if my life lacked purpose, lacked meaning, lacked direction. And so the pilgrimage became a twin challenge. On the one hand, there was the challenge of spending time by myself, in my own head, with my thoughts, with my memories, with my guilt, with my regrets. And so day by day, I was learning how to occupy the space of my own mind. But then there was another challenge, which was that each night I stayed with monks and with nuns, with priests and with families who took me in. I had very little money. I was, on the whole, I was asking for people to take me in. And this also, therefore, challenged me to get out of myself in some way, to learn, to experience, and to share in the lives of the people I was meeting along the way. Many of these were religious communities. I started walking as a non-believer. I'm still a non-believer. But by spending time with these religious communities, I would share in their practices. I'd go to church. I'd sit in prayers with them. And I hoped, and I felt that I did, gain a certain insight into what was happening when they prayed or when they worshipped, why they had chosen to make this, to commit their life to something which beforehand had seemed almost incomprehensible to me.
And did you feel you got closer to being able to answer that question? What actually is that divine connection that those who believe have?
I feel I made some progress in that direction. The first thing that I didn't understand before I set out was that before walking, I thought of religion as essentially a series of arguments about how the world works. Mm. You agree with those arguments or you don't agree with those arguments. Spending time with religious communities, I began to understand that it was also a set of practices, a set of traditions, a form of identity, a way of looking at the world, of engaging with the world, all of these sort of looser, broader understandings of religion. That was the first thing. And then the second thing which I gained an insight into, although I didn't jump over the gulp for myself, was when I was spending time with monastic communities, I realized that when they were praying, you know, sometimes monks will spend 4, 5, 6 hours a day in prayer. Many of them have an inner life, an inner landscape, and that prayer allows them to access that and to explore that, to broaden it out. And that gives them resources that they can then take out into their day-to-day lives. You know, with luck, they'll become more patient, more compassionate, less afraid of death. And so that's how it can then have a tangible benefit in their everyday existence.
One last question to you, and then I'm going to come back to Emma, because there's something you've touched upon which resonates with me, which in any long walk, and like four of you, I've done pilgrimage both on foot and on bicycle, there's that repetitive cadence of one foot in front of the other. Across quite a lot of your book, you give the clue to just the number of times you are counting your own footsteps while you are walking.
Yes.
Can you talk about slightly that the hypnotic sense of that and the sort of... Because sometimes it comes across like you're going through the rosary, the beads on a rosary or something like that. It becomes a... It puts you in an altered state, is perhaps the clumsy way of trying to say what I'm trying to say.
Oh, I'm glad you picked up on that. And indeed, that was my intention with the prose of the book itself, to give some sense of the rhythm of walking. And this, of course, echoes the rhythm of repetitive prayer. In the Eastern Church, which I spent a lot of time in Orthodox countries, they have a real emphasis on repeated prayer enabling you to enter these meditative states. And now, if you're on a long walk, say you're walking 8 hours of the day, 7.5 hours, maybe 7 hours and 50 minutes are going to be spent in a state of mild boredom. Sometimes there's a beautiful view, sometimes there's an interesting encounter, but there's a lot of drudgery. And yet, if you are able to endure that low level of boredom, maybe try to remain alert throughout that level of boredom, then I at least found for maybe 10 minutes a day, maybe 20 minutes a day, or if I was in a church service, 5 minutes out of 2 hours, I would move to the far side of boredom. For a brief moment, my sense of time would begin to loosen. And when that happens, it sounds a bit of a cliche if you don't experience it yourself, but you begin to live in a moment and you become alert to that moment in a way that wasn't previously possible. And for myself, I found that a very restorative process.
You've been nodding your head at so much of what Guy was talking about, Emma. What resonates particularly with you?
No, I've just... The boredom thing is quite interesting.
Talk me through it.
So, I mean, there are writers who say that unless you've experienced boredom, you're not progressed in meditation. There's a point at which you pass from distractedness into a state which is maybe a little bit like boredom. Mm. And at that point, you either fall away or you have the stamina to continue. And so it's just interesting to hear it. But, I mean, we don't have a tradition of walking meditation. In Bhutan,
quite.
We don't do walking meditation. They do it in some other traditions. Yeah. And in my tradition, you have to do 110,000 prostrations, right? And that took me about 9 months. 110,000 prostrations, yeah. After that, I never wanted to walk again, to be frank. So I just sit down now. Just specialise in sitting down, yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about your journey? I'd rather people read it than we told them about it.
Mm.
But you open your book with a horrific incident. You are a successful, powerful businesswoman with a lot of responsibility, living in the Far East. You're in a hotel, you're expecting a delivery of towels or chocolates in your 5-star hotel, you've just kicked off your Manolo Blahniks, your, whatever the suit was, the jacket is lying on the bed.
Versace suit.
And there's a tap on the door, you answer the door, and it's a man with a gun, and you're held at gunpoint.
Yeah.
What takes the woman from that situation, who thankfully is not shot, is not... Nothing bad happens other than you are held hostage for a certain period of time and then other things happen, but nothing bad. It was pretty bad.
I don't recommend it.
You weren't physically assaulted. You weren't...
Oh, I was physically assaulted.
Oh, you were. Oh, forgive me.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't recommend it as a route to pilgrimage.
As a route to pilgrimage.
I really don't recommend my route.
As the starting point of a pilgrimage, that's pretty dramatic. What took the woman that was that onto the path that's led to where you are now?
Well, obviously, you know, when you pleaded for your life with a man with a gun at your head, anything after that is a bonus, right?
Quite. I mean, thought you were going to die.
Yeah, so...
But can you talk
so
us through
you
the
kind
actual
of courage.
Steps?
It gives you courage, right? It just gives you immense courage because I definitely didn't expect to leave that room. I didn't expect the door to ever open. I just thought, you know, I just didn't expect to survive. And so that added to which, you know, I think it's very clear in the book that I felt this enormous sense of I'd done nothing in the world, you know? I'd given nothing to the world I lived in. I'd accumulated suits and I'd wandered about and made decisions and got exams, but I really felt what I needed to do in the world I hadn't done. And I was about to leave it and I'd done nothing of any value. And that... So when I got out of there, in the end, I wasn't going to waste my time.
There's some rather poignant moments in the front of the book, or for the first 100 pages or so, where you paint yourself, and I'm not sure if it's conscious or not, as a somewhat restless soul. Mm. A bright girl from a good family who gets a scholarship to Cambridge, doesn't have to do Oxbridge exams, does 2 and a bit years at Selwyn College, drops out, then goes to art school, tries to find herself through art, then ends up, as long story short, as the banker.
Mm. Yeah, look, I'm definitely looking, I guess.
There's a sense that you were seeking for something.
Yeah.
So when you decided the path that you chose on, was there a sense of homecoming, of redemption, or of this was a journey that was worthy of you?
Yeah, I guess
the way to put it.
That I didn't decide to do this in some sense, right?
Right.
If you remember from the book, my lama in Bhutan instructs me to become ordained.
What I'm trying to get you to tell the story is how you ended up in Rose. What took the girl from Faversham to Bhutan in the first place? How you got started?
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, I did... I think having watched my own mind fall apart after Jakarta.
Yeah.
You know, when you've been through incredible stress and strain like that, your mind it struggles to digest it and place it in an order of your life, you know, because it's such a shocking thing to come in. Yeah. So I'd seen my own mind in a state of great distress. I don't know. I know you sounded as if you'd had some moments there as well. So I knew the power of the mind. The power of the mind to determine your experience, full stop. Just determine your experience. So I think that was quite fascinating to me in the end. And so I'd seen my mind very confused, and I felt that probably it was in the nature of my mind that clarity and wisdom lay. And I wanted to see what was possible, you know. And I think anybody who meditates kind of wants to see what's possible with the mind, you know. What's the limit of the mind? Is there a limit? Or is it really like the sky, you know? I mean, that's something a meditator is going to be interested in.
So, sorry to ask you perhaps in a different way. So what was the introduction to Buddhism? That hinge point, that
oh,
left
no,
turn...
Oh, no, I'd always been interested in Buddhism. I had right. always been interested in Buddhism, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Who can't love the image of a seated Buddha? I'm sure many people here go to Cambodia and Thailand and Laos and Sri Lanka. And who, you know, I mean, it's beautiful to see... The renunciate path, the simple robes.
Right.
Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Justin, you gave us a fantastic introduction as to what catalyzed your pilgrimage to Jerusalem. The confluence of three extraordinary anniversaries, a fantastic cause. But of course, any journey, for whatever cause, whatever greater than us cause, is a personal journey. You are putting one foot in front of the other.
Absolutely.
When did you realize, actually, that you were personally engaged with this on a physical and emotional level, as well as the intellectual level?
Well, I mean, probably at that first moment in Trafalgar Square, where it was my job to rally the pilgrims that had turned up on day one, you know, to take part in this. And you know what Trafalgar Square is like on a Saturday morning, with traffic and buskers and noise and all the rest of it. And we had a rendezvous point, and these people had all booked, you know, and they, we, you know, it wasn't just random turn up, but it was all organised. But I realised that now is the moment to fire the starting pistol, and I need to step up and say some encouraging, hopeful, inspiring things about what we're doing here, you know. Well, and welcome them all, and isn't it fantastic that you're here to join us on this walk, to Jerusalem in support of the rights of the Palestinian people. And in 5 months' time, inshallah, you know, we will walk into Jerusalem. And all the time in my mind, these questions are going, will we? Will we ever get there? Will we, you know, how many of us will make it? Will there be injuries? Will there be illness? You know, will there be problems and bereavements back home, which will mean that people will have to abandon the war? If we get to Jordan, will we even get across the Allenby Bridge? What if the Israelis rumble us and we're all arrested and deported? What if we get into the West Bank and we're starting to do our gesture of solidarity, our big thing, that we're symbolic action that we came to do, and we're attacked or arrested? You know, and all these kind of questions start to arise immediately. And when you feel, I suppose, as a leader, you're responsible for the group. I think I became, in some ways, a kind of vessel for the kind of fantastical anxieties which it's possible to conjure, you know, in any big undertaking. It's a tall order, walking that far over such a long time. And Guy's journey was even harder because he walked alone a lot of the time. And started in winter. And crossing the Great St. Bernard Pass over the Alps in winter is no joke. When we walked over the Alps, the Great St. Bernard Pass, it was hot. It was really, really hot. A journey that day of 40 kilometres, ascending 2,500 metres in height. So a tall order for the knees and hips. But at least the snow wasn't coming down. It's genuinely dangerous to do that in the winter. But we have a refrain at the end of this little morning liturgy or, you know, prayer that we would, it was a sort of non-denominational, non-specific kind of spiritual sort of set of words, you know, because there were people of all faiths and none taking part in this. And the refrain at the end was ambulando solvitur. It will be solved by walking. Okay. And what, while Emma and Guy were both talking just now, I found myself resonating very profoundly with was the sense that through the deeper dimensions of silence, which one comes to through walking, through the rhythm, through the repetition, through the experience physically of being outdoors and using your body for hours and hours and hours every day, the heart pumping, the, you know, and the walking in fellowship with people. It's possible, you go through boredom, you go to the far side of boredom, as you said, and what I found often was that through the deep wells of silence, very, very intense sensations, either of joy or of profound sorrow or of fear would emerge. So one that comes to mind, our last day of walking in Italy, walking down the final stretch of the Adriatic coast into Ancona, and it'd been unbelievably hot through the whole month of August walking through Italy. Fantastically hot. We were starting at 5:30 in the morning sometimes to try and beat the heat. And the heavens opened on the last morning. And our route at that point was a Roman road called the Via Flaminia, which kind of turned into a motorway. And so we were walking down this verge of this motorway with the rain pouring down and these huge lorries thundering past, thinking, actually not terribly safe, actually. and think, well, we'd climb up onto a kind of concrete wall. So we might have a 12-foot drop, but at least we're not going to get crushed by a lorry. And I found, apropos of nothing, these profound sensations of regret emerging about all the ways in which I felt I'd failed as a parent to my children. I'm married, I'm happily four wonderful children, 21 down to 13. So I'm not talking about anything spectacular. I'm talking about the times when you shouted at him, the times when you failed to understand, when you were impatient, when you, you know, that sort of thing. I'm not talking about anything terrible. But for some reason, on the last morning of walking in Italy, in this deluge, I found all these sorts of feelings of, I don't know, self-recrimination or regret or something about things that one had failed to be as a parent, and sort of somehow feeling able also to let go of that. And somehow through the walk and through the rain and through the companion who was walking with me at that time, a friend called Naomi, I didn't speak to her about it, but somehow her presence next to me was consoling, that I was able to sort of feel that I maybe hadn't done such a bad job as a parent, that I could let myself off the hook and that you know, we do the best we can, you know, at the time. And it was, that was just an example of a kind of a
so
moment.
Did you go straight from regret to letting go? Was there anything in between?
No, it was a kind of, now what do I do with this? You know, what do I, because I, you know, sort of the walking and the physical ordeal of being drenched in the rain, and it's a long day of walking, and all those sorts of feelings created the space, I think, to look at unpleasant feelings and somehow get a perspective on them, and perhaps then feel that I can now release that, if that makes sense.
It sort of does.
Does it make sense?
I think maybe that's one of the repeated experiences that a pilgrim will encounter. Anyone who has been on a longer pilgrimage, what they will find is that they're walking each day, sometimes with company, but even if they're with company, a lot of time they're in silence, a lot of time they're occupying the chambers of their own mind, and there's no distraction. in your everyday life, if you encounter a thought that's uncomfortable, it's very, very easy to distract yourself. You pick up your phone, you turn on the radio, you write an email, suddenly you've forgotten about it. If you're walking, you don't have that way of distracting yourself. And so what you find often happens is that you encounter thoughts that for years you have potentially been neglecting, not engaging with. Thoughts of one's mortality, thoughts of one's regrets, those fundamental questions. Why am I here? What am I living for? These are not easy questions to engage with, not easy questions to answer. But the simple process of confronting them without distraction, I think, is the beginning to learning how to engage with them. And then pilgrimage offers something else as well, which is that if you're, for example, on a walking pilgrimage, you're likely to be in an unfamiliar country, an unfamiliar terrain. Perhaps the language is new to you. Perhaps the culture is unfamiliar. And you're therefore placed in a position of humility. Simply to complete the next stage of your journey, you're going to have to ask people for help, ask them for advice. You're going to have to shed some of the independence, some of the autonomy, which you've spent much of your life building up. Mm. And when you're in that position of the way I like to think of it is that the pilgrimage, in a way, builds up the muscle of humility. When you're in that position of humility, it therefore becomes a little bit easier to confront these very difficult questions as we've been talking about, and even to think that you maybe will look elsewhere for guidance into how to continue navigating your life, how to answer these questions.
Does that resonate with you, Emma? Guys, what a rather wonderful phrase. Part of the result of a pilgrimage is building the muscle of humility.
I mean... Yeah, I mean, what they've been saying is quite interesting in many ways, actually.
Try not to fiddle.
Oh, sorry. It's interesting that this notion of regretting and then letting go, that's interesting, that because from a Buddhist point of view, that's quite a... it's the result of letting go that's interesting, right? It doesn't finish with letting go. Secondly, from a Himalayan Buddhist point of view, distraction would definitely take place within walking. Walking is a form of distraction.
Right.
Because you're constantly changing the circumstances. So in fact, from a Himalayan point of view, or even a Zen Buddhist point of view, staying in one place is in itself a huge discipline. So although you described walking as a way to be away from distraction, from a Himalayan point of view, walking is itself a form of distraction. You're giving the mind content all the time, narrative to look at, right?
Yeah.
So, and then I can't remember my third thing. What was the third thing? Wait a minute, hold on a sec. Sorry. What was the other thing?
Humility.
That's it, humility, yeah. So that's a realization of the nature of reality. We are all absolutely in the debt of each other, dependent on each other. You know, I didn't bring this chair up here. I didn't make this water bottle. You know, you're helping, you're asking questions. So that's the nature of reality. And it seems as if he has whether he calls it humility or not, it's just the nature of reality. And he's obviously understood that really well. Guy's obviously really understood that.
So humility
that
is
process.
A form of the understanding.
But you can understand it through many things. Look at a mother giving their every hour to bring up this child and, you know, whatever. We forget that we're all indebted to each other. How we treat each other is so important. We should never think that we're this isolated, independent thing. It causes so many problems and misunderstandings in the world, isn't it? So,
so I like that. So, So pilgrimage is a way to work up the muscle of humility, and humility is nothing but the recognition
of the nature of
our
reality.
Interconnectedness with the world
nature
around us.
Nature of reality. That is nature of reality.
Justin.
All I was simply going to observe that it depends what kind of pilgrimage you do.
Quite.
If it's a solo pilgrimage.
Does it? Does it matter? Does it depend?
No, it doesn't matter.
Surely the point is that
I'm
it doesn't.
I'm so going to... No, I'm definitely
Emma's point
definitely
is that it doesn't. It doesn't have
her.
To be a mobile pilgrimage.
My point is only to say that because we were a group travelling together...
I see, right.
...and we were living in each other's pockets...
Yeah, yeah.
...that we very much had to develop both humility and enormous patience, you know, because snoring, sharing rooms, you know, doctoring each other's feet...
The compromise of collaboration.
Yes, the diet, people's dietary requirements, what time we're setting off in the morning. You know, being part of a kind of itinerant community like that requires constant subordination of your own will, you know, to the group. You know, that was the only, all I was, it was a compromise.
Oh, no, I'm it's a good thing.
Okay, one last question for me, then we'll open it to the floor. And forgive me if there's a little, I may even not have got the phrasing right of it, but it's on my mind. Does pilgrimage, whether physical or internal, spiritual, stationary pilgrimage, have to have an end point? Does there have to be a redemptive point of we've got there? Does there have to be journey's end? Or is actually the pilgrimage itself enough, and actually the pilgrimage, even if it hasn't it, even if you get to Jerusalem or Rome or Santiago, actually it's still just part of a much wider journey?
That's a great question. It's a phrase that sometimes you hear amongst pilgrims, the journey is the destination. Hmm. You know, that you set out with a goal in mind, Jerusalem, you know, Rome, Santiago, whatever, you know. And of course, the structure and the meaning and the time scale and the distance and everything, you know, that defines the practical sort of scope of your endeavor. But the journey is the destination in the sense that you find some of the things that you find along the way, or as we said every day, ambulando solvitur.
Yep.
It will be solved by walking. On our last day of walking in Europe, our last day walking into the old city of Istanbul, I organized our group in the morning and we read a wonderful poem by Constantine Cavafy, a Greek poet, called Ithaca. And Ithaca was the home of Odysseus, mm-hmm. that he was trying to get back to. You know, after the Trojan War, he spent 10 years, having been at war for 10 years, he then spent 10 years trying to get home and being buffeted by fate from one misadventure to the other. That's the Odyssey. And his wife, Penelope, was waiting faithfully for him at home, all that. And Constantine Cavafy, the Greek poet, says, you know,
we're running
on your
short
way,
of time.
You will meet all these fantastic adventures and these extraordinary encounters. And pray that the journey is long. Better to arrive in your old age. And if when you arrive, you find Ithaca poor, do not blame her. Ithaca gave you this marvelous journey. Without her, you would never have set out.
Very nice. Thank you, Justin. Guy, you made it to Jerusalem. Plenty of hardship. Was there a redemptive sense to your arrival? Was the destination worthy of the journey?
My journey didn't, in fact, end in Jerusalem.
Quite.
It's true that I made it to Jerusalem. I spent about a week in the city. And then, towards the end of my time in Jerusalem, I realized that at every stage of my journey that I had come to one of these blockbuster religious sites, Rome, Istanbul, Jerusalem, at every stage I had felt that whatever insights I may have gained into myself or into spiritual practices, these had not come in the blockbuster sites. They'd not often come in remote, quiet, out-of-the-way places. And so what I did was I carried on walking. I went south to Bethlehem, and then I carried on walking again all the way to the Judean desert. And when I reached the Judean desert, there is a monastery called Mar Saba, which is perched above the Kidron Valley, this long valley leading from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea. And when I came to this monastery, I knocked on the door, and I said to the guest master, "Hello, I've walked here from England, from Canterbury. Is there any chance I could stay the night?" And at this point, I must have slept in about 100 monasteries over the course of my journey. Every single one of them had let me in. But the guest master sucked his teeth and he looked at the ground and he said, "Well, do you have a letter from the Orthodox Patriarch?" I did not. And so he said, "Well, I'm very sorry, you can't stay then. But we have some hermit caves lining the valley wall. You could spend the night in one of those. So I went down into the valley, I crossed over the wadi, and I went into one of these hermit caves, and I found one that looked comfortable. I took off my rucksack, and as I sat, as the light was coming down, and I sat in the valley leading down to the lowest place on earth, I realized that this was where my journey would end. And when I have told people this story subsequently, they've asked, well, was this a disappointing end to your journey? And I said, no, it wasn't. Because this enabled me to gain the very insight you're talking about.
Right.
That the destination was just the excuse for the journey. But there was another insight as well, which is that I no longer thought about the journey in terms of highs and lows, ups and downs. I was so glad for where I had got to, that I was glad for the good points, the kindness and generosity I was shown, and the bad points, the terrorist attacks I encountered, the life, near-death experiences. And so it was only by reaching that conclusion, that place, that I was able to feel glad for everything that had led me there.
It's a bit of a spoiler for the end of the book, but it was a marvellous way to end your journey. The way Guy writes about it brought me to tears when I was reading this. I really commend his book to you. So you get the final word, Emma, and it's the same question. What is your interpretation of pilgrimage and the relationship between the journey and the destination? How do you perceive destination?
No, I think that's where we have to have a Tibetan prayer, I think, to finish, isn't it? So let's say, Sangye Chutang Sokgi Chuknamla Jangjuk Bado Dani Chapsu Chi Dagi Jin Sokjin Pei Sunamgi Jola Penche Sangye Jukpa Sho. In the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, I take refuge for however many lifetimes it may take to reach enlightenment for the benefit of all beings.
Thank you, Emma. I'm not going to let you off the hook with answering a question, though, first.
That's my answer.
Why should we be... No, please, because you are Bhutan. You do live in Bhutan, and there are people here who are, of course, sending holidays to Bhutan. Should we be coming to Bhutan?
Yes, and come and see me. Yeah, come and visit me, please.
Because Bhutan relies very heavily on its tourist industry.
Yeah. Yeah, come and see Bhutan and come and talk to some friends of mine.
And
yeah.
If people want to come and see you in Bhutan, where do they come to?
So they should get the book. This is the way to come to Bhutan. Get the book. In the book is my charity email for the school I'm building in Bhutan. And you can just email me. And if there's a delay, it's because I'm in retreat. So be patient if I don't answer immediately. But just find me here. It's easy.
Thank you so much, Emma. Would you like to?
Travel to Palestine?
Please do.
Only because it's a very simple parallel. That if you want to visit Palestine, if you want to come and visit the West Bank, it's safe to do so. Mm-hmm. Please do. Amos Trust is the human rights charity that I work closely with. There are a number of others. McCabe Pilgrimages, ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition, any number of different groups that organise holidays to the West Bank. You can stay in Bethlehem, in the Palestinian city of Bethlehem. Spend your tourist dollars there to support the Palestinian economy. It really is safe, and it's a wonderful country. Of course, you see the occupation everywhere. You see the walls and the checkpoints and all that. But it's also a very beautiful country and very wonderful, hospitable culture. And so it is possible to visit and holiday and come away feeling very, very inspired. So please do explore that.
Shukran, Justin. So there we go. Three opportunities for spiritually ethical travel. May you travel well. Would you please give huge thanks to Emma Slade, Justin Butcher, and Guy Stagg. Thank you all very much indeed.